When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see.
Welcome back, and welcome to those who are new. This is the fourth lecture in the series on genocide in Canada. And tonight I wanted to carry on from our discussion last week, which had to do with the 19th century in Canada and the legislation that was passed, which laid the groundwork for legal genocide in Canada. I wanted to focus tonight on the development of the residential schools. And since this was one of the main mechanisms for legal genocide in Canada, it's really important to understand what those were as an institution, especially since you don't get much information from the mainstream media or even within academia about the nature of those institutions. I wanted to start out by sharing three quotes from, these are all from people within mainstream society, these are all from civil servants. The first quote is from Dr. Peter Bryce, who was medical inspector for the Indian residential schools in 1907. He said, "I believe the conditions are being deliberately created in our Indian residential schools to spread infectious diseases. The death rate often exceeds 50%. This is a national crime." Now, the official that he wrote to about this, Duncan Campbell Scott, who was the Czar of Indian Affairs for over 40 years in Canada, he wrote in actually just 3 years after that, quote, "It is true that Indian children usually die at a much higher rate in our residential schools, but such is in keeping with the policy of this department, which is concerned with the final solution of the Indian problem in Canada," unquote. So the term final solution didn't start with Adolf. Third quote from Neil Parker, who was superintendent of Indian Affairs in Ottawa in 1949. "If I was responsible for a group of Indian children and wished to eliminate half of them through exposure to communicable diseases, there is no finer tool than your average residential school," unquote. So these are not from wild-eyed radicals. These are from people right within the system who are responsible for the operation of the Indian residential schools. And these candid admissions from the most senior civil servants in Canada at different times in the 20th century tell us much about the nature of Indian residential schools. But they also reveal the entrenched and institutionalized nature of genocide in Canada as a legal method of exterminating non-Christian peoples. The words of Nazi hunter Simon Wiesenthal take on a sudden relevancy in Canada when he said, quote, "In a regime where murder is officially sanctioned, there can be no regret and no apology." And I wanted to repeat that. In a regime where murder is officially sanctioned, there can be no regret and no apology. So tonight's lecture will attempt to answer the question of why there can be no regret or apology by Canadian churches and government for the general fact of genocide that was committed on Native people in residential schools. Simply put, genocide was not only legal, but it was moral in the minds of the institutions that operated the schools. The extermination of non-Christian Indians was not only required theologically, but economically by the conquering culture of which we are still a part. In last week's lecture, I traced the main developments in the genocide of Indians in Canada during the 18th and 19th centuries, with the Gradual Civilization Act of 1857 and the Indian Act of 1874. The Christian state reduced Indians to the legal status of slaves in their own country, and specifically reduced them to the conditions of wards of the state, people who had no inherent rights, could not vote or go to court, or disobey any rule imposed on them by missionaries or Indian agents. And one of the examples we had of that was the requirement of every Indian person having to have a pass to leave a reserve. And that requirement actually was in place till well into the 1960s. And as a matter of fact, I've spoken to people on northern Vancouver Island who even in the 1970s had to go to the Indian agent to get off the reserve. They needed a little pink pass, they called it. As a result of these laws, most of the remaining free Indians in Canada were forced off their land and died in the hundreds of thousands from smallpox and other diseases that were deliberately spread among them, not only by settlers, but even by missionaries. The Eastern Indian nations had been either exterminated or safely imprisoned on reserves by the time that the Canadian Pacific Railway linked the entire country in 1886. But Western Indians were a different matter altogether. Well into the 20th century, the West was untamed and full of non-treated Indian nations who still followed their traditional way of life and occupied their ancestral lands. My own grandfather, Ross Annett, describes when he had gone out to Alberta as a young man in 1911, he used to go out hunting with Blackfoot and Sioux warriors, some of whom were veterans of the battles against the U.S. cavalry, and he used to go out and hunt antelope with them in what's now Alberta. They were roaming free and uncaged across the prairies as recently as 1911. Naturally, this caused great worry in the corridors of power in Canada, especially among the missionary churches, the Roman Catholics, the Anglicans, and the Presbyterians and Methodists, who were the predecessors to the United Church. Commented a Catholic bishop in 1901, quote, "Our country will never be united and strong while pagan savages are left to hunt and fish freely." The fact that in BC in 1900, over three-quarters of the Indian nations were still not Christians and occupied vast areas of forests and lands not ceded by treaty. And this fact was one of the main reasons that residential schools were launched with such a passion here in British Columbia in the early years of the 20th century. Now, the residential schools were not a new idea. They had been experimented with on and off, especially in Quebec and Ontario, all during the early and mid-1800s. But none of these projects really got much government recognition or support. But with the opening up of the rest of the country, the church and state began to coordinate their efforts much more. And as I mentioned last week, what happened in Western Canada, and especially in BC, was that legal genocide occurred in three phases. The first one being outright conquest and extermination. The second phase, that of containment. And the third, actual assimilation. Now, the residential schools were created after the success of the first stage, the outright invasion and extermination, which went on in BC during the period 1840 to 1880, in which there were three successive waves of smallpox, which exterminated about 90% of the Indians here on the coast. So-called white Canadians have a mental barrier when it comes to the reality that this smallpox was deliberately spread in British Columbia. Not only are there oral accounts among the nations up and down the coast of tales of British sailors and others spreading blankets that were infected with disease in the various coastal villages, but I actually have copies of proclamations by the city councils of New Westminster and Victoria in 1861 and 1864 respectively that actually order all Indians who have smallpox to return to their villages and remain there apart from all non-native settlers. Now, that's not the way you cure smallpox. That's the way you spread it. You don't quarantine people. You force them to go and live among the healthy so that they all die as a result of it. And this accounted, for example, I cite the case of Harriet Nahani, a member of our network, whose village of Clouse, which is north of Port Renfrew, had a population of around 3,500 in 1861 and 44 people by 1890, a decline of almost 99% due to these smallpox. So imagine an area where 99% of the people are just wiped out, and that's what happened in a lot of the coastal villages. Now, this practice of forcing sick people to go live among healthy ones was developed to a fine art in the residential schools, and in fact, I contend that one of the reasons the death rate was so consistently high was because of this practice. The main practice of extermination in the residential schools was children who were sick with tuberculosis were allowed into the schools and housed along the children who were healthy. We had eyewitnesses who experienced that give testimony at our tribunal in 1998. And Dr. Prudy Bryce, who I mentioned earlier, describes in detail how that practice was occurring literally in every residential school in the West that he examined in the year 1907. By spreading these diseases among West Coast tribes, the colonial power and the missionaries had reduced the native population to about 1 to 2% of the original number after about two generations. So by 1890, there were barely 20,000 native people left in British Columbia, down from what we figure was a pre-contact population of at least several million. And it was at this point when the population curve was at its bottom that the residential schools were officially launched with government sanction and church oversight. Now, clearly, the plan was to take the surviving remnant of the decimated Indian nations and eradicate them as a people right at the time when white settlers and logging companies and mining companies needed access to their land. Some of the documentary evidence of this is found right at UBC in the Kerner Library, where I've been delving into for about 7 years now. And this evidence consists largely of the actual records and letters of the residential schools, the Indian agents, and so on, in BC, spanning almost a century. You won't find that evidence anywhere else in Canada, because after the lawsuits began against the churches and government, these records started mysteriously disappearing from university libraries. And in fact, the government brought in legislation which said any of that information could only be obtained now through access to information applications to the federal government. And one of my friends tried this, and he was told that he could not look at any document which named a person, because that might violate confidentiality at a time when people were going to court. Well, most of these documents, they don't make any sense unless they're in the context of the naming of a person. Most of the documents involve naming people. And so, in effect, it's a way of banning 95 of these documents from public scrutiny. But the UBC is unique in this sense, because the records were obtained before the lawsuits began, and it's a real goldmine of information. I urge people to go then look through it themselves. In discussing the residential schools, I want to make it clear at the beginning that we have to avoid the practice of genocidal regimes everywhere, which is of using language in relation to mass murder, which is designed to mask and rationalize that murder. We especially owe it to the victims of those crimes not to belittle their suffering and their fate by seeing some kind of positive value in these schools, so-called schools, when they were clearly an attempt to exterminate indigenous people through murder, torture, and various horrendous practices, including sterilization programs. The Nazis officially described their own death camps as, quote, relocation centers, where Jews and others were, quote, transported to receive, quote, special treatment, unquote. In Canada, the final solution of Indians was referred to as civilizing, and then later as assimilation. To conceal the true nature of this genocide, the process was run by Christian churches in special internment camps, deceptively called residential schools. These facilities were set up under the direct authority of the mainline churches, with the sanction and partial funding of the Department of Indian Affairs in Ottawa. They were run by a single man with virtually absolute power, the principal, who was almost always a clergyman or a church official. By 1900, there were about 110 residential schools in Canada, most of them in Western Canada. Two-thirds of these were Catholic schools. The rest were run by the Anglicans or the predecessors to the United Church, the Presbyterians and Methodists. By 1910, between one-half and two-thirds of the children admitted each year were dead by the end of the school year, usually from tuberculosis and other infectious diseases. And what's significant is this death rate was constant year after year in both Protestant and Catholic schools. Now that fact, if you take that fact and remember it, it's our first clue in this detective story, which is discovering the real nature of the residential schools. Half of the children in an institution don't die every year unless there's a common and regular policy at work. Since the theory put out by the government and the churches, which is that these lone abusers who are acting on their own authority had violated children these crimes are being acknowledged and compensated for, the lone abuser theory doesn't explain how half the children died every year, because obviously individual abusers can't kill off half the population of the school. The policy behind this consistent death rate was described in detail by Dr. Peter Bryce, who I mentioned already. Bryce was the chief medical inspector for the Ontario Health Commission, and he was hired by the Department of Indian Affairs in 1907 to study Indian residential schools and the health conditions there. Duncan Campbell Scott wanted to whitewash a lot of these reports coming out, so he expected to send in one of his flunkies who would send back a sanitized report, as was usually the practice. But Peter Bryce was one of those unique people who was an honest man who was trying to keep his integrity within a federal bureaucracy. And Peter Bryce went to virtually every residential school in the West and on the coast of BC. And he wrote a scathing report which got himself not only fired but expelled from the civil service and blacklisted all over the country. The policy that he uncovered was a practice in the residential schools of deliberately exposing children to tuberculosis and then letting them die untreated in very unhealthy and unsanitary conditions. Bryce discovered this practice going on literally in every residential school in the West during the spring and the fall of 1907 when he toured those schools. In fact, so shocked was Bryce by what he discovered, including the blatant efforts by church officials to conceal this murder going on, that he wrote a scathing report that not only got him fired, but was eventually quoted in the Ottawa Citizen in its issue of November 15th, 1907, right on the front headline, in which a death rate of 69% was described in Western Indian residential schools. Even though Bryce was forced out of the civil servant and pretty much blacklisted, he wrote a book about it called A National Crime. And John Molloy, who's a scholar at Trent University, has written a book called A National Crime in which he cites Bryce's work quite consistently. Molloy, who's a very reputable scholar, cites the death rates in one of his chapters of 50 to 75%. Now, a quote from Dr. Bryce's Duncan Campbell Scott in 1907 says, as I quoted earlier, the conditions are being deliberately created in our residential schools to spread infectious diseases. Now remember those two words, deliberately created. Those keywords show intent to commit murder. And as I said, it's not as if the public and the government aren't aware of these facts, because they were right on the front headline of one of the major newspapers in Canada in 1907, the Ottawa Citizen. Now, the reaction of the government and the churches to Bryce's evidence was exactly the same as what goes on today, 100 years later. They denied it and tried to silence not only the evidence, but whistleblowers like Dr. Bryce. Bryce was banned from the public service and subjected to a smear campaign that prevented him from ever working again, even as a doctor. One of the things that Duncan Campbell Scott did was he went to the national tuberculosis convention held every year by the doctors in Canada, because tuberculosis was a very widespread disease even among the white population back then. And Scott made sure that Bryce's report didn't get on the agenda of that body and did a very thorough smear campaign, which some of us who have gone through the same thing know all about. But what was interesting, one of the statistics that came out of that 1910 convention of the National Tuberculosis Association was the government themselves admitted that among white Canadians, the government was spending about $3 per capita on the prevention of tuberculosis and 8 cents per capita among Indian people to prevent tuberculosis. So look at that discrepancy, and that again is a piece of evidence that tells you something. Now, it's hardly surprising that the government and churches reacted this way to the concrete evidence of deliberate genocide going on in residential schools, because in the same year, in 1910, in August, there was a very high-level meeting that went on in Ottawa between officials of the government and the churches. And this was basically to lay out the legal framework for responsibility over the residential schools. At the meeting were representatives of the Treasury Board, Indian Affairs, the Prime Minister's Office, and the RCMP, and all the highest officials of the Roman Catholic, Anglican, Presbyterian, and Methodist churches. Now, these men came up with a legal contract which gave overall operating authority over the schools to the churches, and the churches would not have to be accountable to anybody, whether that be Parliament or even the Indian Affairs. The only supervision of the schools that was done by the government was the form of annual visits that were supposed to be made by federal Indian agents, who often, especially in the West, were former missionaries themselves who had allegiances to the churches. Now, the classic example I found of that, you know, the absurdity of that whole system, was I found a letter in the Kerner Library at UBC from the Indian Affairs Archives, and I have this letter printed in my book, Hidden from History. It's a letter from the Indian agent for the West Coast Agency, Peter Ashbridge, and he was writing about a fire that took place at the Ahauset Indian Residential School in 1940. And it was often the case that the only form of resistance Native people had in these schools was to burn them down. And so there's continual cases of this happening in the wooden structures. And Peter Ashbridge is writing to the government. He had examined the situation after the fire, and he has this classical statement. He said, quote, "As this was the property of the church, care was taken to avoid too close an inquiry," unquote. So he's admitting in black and white that he didn't investigate the fire and the events around it because he didn't want to embarrass the churches. And so this was very much the attitude. I mean, let's not forget that, as I've mentioned in previous talks, there is no separation between church and state in practice in Canada. We never had that kind of Republican revolution that they had in the States. And the in practice, the as I mentioned with the case of the missionary John Ross, church and state offices were often even held by one person, by missionaries who had been made magistrates, so they could set up special courts to try native elders and so on. So the thing to remember is that then and now, right up to the present day, the government continues to cover in this way for the churches, assuming legal liability for the residential schools, taking on getting taxpayers to cover the legal bill of the churches that are being sued by the various survivors and that kind of thing. And the most recent absurdity is last year the government even passed legislation which limited the number of lawsuits which could be brought by survivors of the residential schools. So in effect, if you're a native person now trying to sue, you can't really do it anymore because there's been a lid put on that by the Prime Minister's office. So when this original agreement was established in 1910, the government of Canada gave the churches a completely free hand to deal with non-Christian Indians in any way they liked. Now, and here's the second clue of intent to commit genocide. One of the first things the churches demanded and won was the abolition of any medical inspection of the residential schools. In 1920, Duncan Campbell Scott abolished the post of medical inspector for residential schools, despite the epidemic levels of tuberculosis among Indian children there. Within 2 years, the tuberculosis rate had tripled in these schools. Clue number three is that in the same year, in 1920, federal legislation was passed by order and council, not through parliament, where it might be scrutinized, but by order and council, that made it mandatory for every Indian child in Canada between the ages of 7 and 15 to attend residential schools. So let's put those three clues together. One, Indian children die at a rate of nearly 75% every year in the residential schools. Two, the churches running these schools demand complete secrecy in their operation and the abolition of any medical inspection of the children. Three, the government legally compels Indian children into these schools despite epidemic levels of disease and death there and the absence of any health inspection. What does that tell you? At the Nuremberg trials, exactly this same combination of clues led the Allies to find Nazi officials guilty of planned genocide of the Jews and other peoples. To quote Robert Jackson, the chief American prosecutor at Nuremberg, quote, "No regime bent on exterminating another people will describe their intent in so many words, since such intent is embedded in the very operation of the system of extermination. On the contrary, the actions of the agencies of murder are enough proof of such intent. And therefore, when the transport of people into conditions of disease and death is condoned and facilitated by a government, and when these crimes are concealed from the scrutiny of the world by the same government or other agencies, it can be safely asserted that this regime intends to annihilate the targeted people and is guilty before the world of crimes against humanity." Unquote. So long before Hitler and during and after his regime, the churches and governments of Canada perpetrated exactly the same crimes described by Robert Jackson, using the same legal authority and policy of concealment of the Nazis. The only difference between these two genocides is that our homegrown crimes occurred right here in Canada, and the group targeted for extermination were non-Christian Indians. Now, when you rely on the statistics of the government themselves, of the Indian Affairs in Kerner Library, more than 100,000 Indian children died or were killed in the residential schools between 1910 and 1984, when the last school closed in northern BC. The high mark of overt killings took place between 1929 and 1965, although the practices behind these killings continued in every period. But what caused so many more children to die in the 1930s to the 1950s was two things. First of all, the assumption of legal guardianship by the church-appointed principal. And the second thing was the stripping of any legal defense granted to Indians between 1929 and 1953. Because during those years, Indians were denied the right to hire or even consult a lawyer anywhere in Canada. And if you're a lawyer and you took on an Indian client, you'd be permanently disbarred. Again, this federal legislation was passed order and council away from the scrutiny of Parliament. Both of these events were related to the overall plan of culling down the members of surviving Indians nations by at least one half. To do so efficiently, to keep up that level of death, the residential school principal had to become the absolute legal guardian over these children. Hence, the transfer of guardianship to the principal by the government around 1929. This is something I discovered in Kerner Library. One day I came across this document, the application for admission form, which granted the principal legal guardianship of the children. And in 1925, a letter from the head of Indian Affairs said that the government was still the legal guardian of the kids. So in the late 20s, this shift happened. And there's never to this day been an official explanation from the government as to why it surrendered such guardianship over its own legal wards to the churches. It's been asked. I've asked them on numerous occasions, but they've never answered. But it was only after this transfer of legal guardianship that we begin to hear the most notorious cases of and examples of torture, sexual sterilization, and pedophilia beginning to occur in the residential schools. Now, to give you an example of that, in the last nearly 10 years, I estimate I've interviewed close to 2,000 Native people who went through residential schools, and the vast majority of those testimonies that describe sterilizations and active pedophile networks among operating out of the residential schools, they're documented to have occurred between 1934 and 1952. That is, during the period when not only the churches were legal guardians of the kids, but Native parents had no legal recourse to protect their own children. The transfer of legal guardianship to the churches was the tool used by the latter to unleash literally a reign of terror against West Coast Indians between the 1930s and 60s. Now, when you look at the reason behind this, one of the things I speculate is that this was a time when the lands and resources in Western Canada especially had become extremely valuable and important to the developing industries and the war industries of Canada and the United States. The post-war economic boom in North America was fueled in many ways by the water, the timber, the minerals of this part of Canada. Resources which were obtained here in BC only because the churches had first been given absolute power to evict Indians from their land at will, to confuse their language and cultural identity, and to torture and murder them at random in their residential schools. One of the main tools the churches had in this effort was legislation, which allowed them to sterilize non-Christian Indians en masse. In 1929 in Alberta and in 1933 in BC, the Sexual Sterilization Acts were passed, which gave industrial school principals, which included residential schools, the power to recommend the involuntary sterilization of any student in his charge to a eugenics board, which had been appointed by a joint church and government body. Under this law, at least 40,000 Indian women and men in BC and Alberta were sterilized simply because they were Indians who didn't regularly practice Christianity. The United Church of Canada led the sterilization campaign on the West Coast in two main centers, the R.W. Large Hospital in Bella Bella and the Nanaimo Indian Hospital. The Bella Bella Hospital is still in operation. The Nanaimo Hospital closed in the late 60s. Smaller sterilization clinics were run in Duncan and in Campbell River. The main actor in these sterilizations for nearly 30 years was a man called Dr. George Darby, who was a United Church medical missionary who was paid by Indian Affairs an average of $300 in the 1950s for every Indian woman he sterilized. And the people he targeted tended to be those women who didn't attend church or who married traditional chiefs or other non-assimilated Indians. Now, a lot of this was shared to me personally by eyewitnesses living in the area in the Cowichan territory around Duncan and on northern Vancouver Island. But George Darby actually admitted these things to several eyewitnesses who gave testimony at our tribunal in 1998, Ed Martin and Ethel Wilson from Bella Bella, who described, to give you the stories, they shared publicly and to UN investigators in June 98. Ed Martin described how he went to Dr. Darby in 1952 because he had 10 children and he couldn't feed them all, and so he requested a vasectomy. And Dr. Darby refused outright. He said, "Ed, you're a good Anglican. You go to church. I only sterilize the pagans." Ethel Wilson was somebody who married a traditional elder, and she was warned several times by Dr. Darby that if she did that, she would have to report for a special procedure at the hospital. And she avoided him, but the Indian agent, again, people couldn't leave the reserve. The Indian agent said, "If you want to leave this reserve, you're going to have to go to Dr. Darby." Ethel Wilson, in her living room in 1998, described to me how she went when she was pregnant and was forced to have the baby delivered. After that, when she woke up, she found not only were her gold teeth missing from her mouth, but she was continually bleeding, and she discovered subsequently that she had been sterilized while under anesthesia by Dr. Darby. Now, these practices were regularly performed by Dr. Darby and his associates for many decades, and other practices described by eyewitnesses who spoke at our tribunal and in other forums. Massive electric shock treatments to children to erase memory, experimental testing of vaccines on children, skin grafting and eye color alteration, pain threshold experiments such as immersing children in ice water or driving needles into their tongues. Now, all of these things, if people are student of the Nazi Holocaust, there's a familiar ring to them, because they were many of the things actually undertaken by Nazi doctors in Auschwitz and other experimental centers. And in fact, there is a link that we've established, because under Project Paperclip, which was an American and British operation which brought over Nazi scientists after the war, a component of Project Paperclip included mind control and behavior modification programs, which were part of the CIA's MKUltra. And several Indian survivors in Ontario who I've spoke to described being treated by a doctor who had an SS tattoo on his arm, and who described himself, used the pseudonym of Dr. Green. And from the physical description they gave and the reference of a Dr. Green, we believe that man was Joseph Mengele, who used apparently native children from reserves and residential schools in some of his experiments. Now, these horrible tortures could only be performed so regularly with the full knowledge and concealment of church and state in a system of legal genocide where Indian people were and continue to remain expendable. But even more precisely, the purpose behind this reign of terror was the traumatizing of entire generations of young Native people for a very clear purpose, and that is to create two permanent classes of Indian people, those who were assimilated and those who were expendable. Now, I suggest that the residential schools were in fact a huge experiment in social engineering in order not only to destroy Native identity and force people off their land, but to create an altogether new Aboriginal society, a two-tiered society consisting of a brainwashed Native elite who identify with white society and in fact end up working as a branch of the state, and an impoverished, inwardly crushed majority whose condition would eventually cause their long-term destruction. Now, in reality, this experiment worked very successfully, and I mentioned before, all you have to do is look at the condition of urban Native people to see that. But the assimilated Native class, or the Phil Fontaines and the Ed Johns of the world, those who think, act, and dress like their white masters and who cannot imagine an other world than the state-funded white one, they're the ones who, as children in the residential schools, learned how to play the game, to inform on their fellow students, and even helped to beat and molest them in exchange for better food and an education. Harry Nahani and others described that on the morning they arrived at the residential school in Alberta, in Port Alberni rather, they were lined up in rows, 300 children, and as they were having their heads shaved and DDT sprayed all over them, there was a group of Native children standing off to the side dressed up like white kids and speaking English. And these kids, when Harriet and others started talking their language, these kids came over with leather straps and started beating them, just like the Zonderkommando in Auschwitz would do, acting at the behest of the white masters. Well, these children were rewarded. Harriet describes that she never went to school. She was given the task all the time of washing walls and doing domestic chores. But the kids who got to go to school and get an education were these collaborators. And they're the ones who came, they were the educated class, they're the ones who often run the tribal councils now and are the official spokespeople on television for Native people. So it's important to remember that this is not accidental. In any colonial system, there's the unassimilated majority and a collaborating elite that are being deliberately created by the system to manage the entire genocidal system on behalf of the state. It's called neocolonialism. There's a cartoon describing that in the African context. There's a cartoon showing entitled Colonialism, and it showed a white man holding a gun to a black man's head. And neocolonialism is a black man holding a gun to his own head. And that's, in fact, the way the system continues to operate in Canada. Any colonial system creates such a divided and ruled subject population, and Christian Canada has been no different. In fact, as I described before, the British Empire were probably the best empire since the Romans in perfecting the system of creating a collaborating elite. occupying such vast resources needed by first the British and then the American empires, the native people of Canada had to be destroyed and the remnant managed under the formal leadership of a native elite working with the state in their own demise. The enthusiastic statements of Assembly of First Nation Grand Chief Phil Fontaine over free trade and economic partnerships with multinational corporations is but a more blatant example of this purpose behind centuries of genocide in Canada. None of this could have occurred in the 20th century without the residential schools and the Christian imperial idea behind them. But as the present day approached, new methods to destroy Native identity and land rights had to be found by churches and their partners in Ottawa. I want to examine those changes in next week's lecture and show how all of this relates to the bigger question of what genocide is today in Canada, how we can expose it and how we can resist it. And that's it for tonight. Thanks. Thank you.